Well, good morning, TNC family. I'm talking to you from my house, sitting in front of my home computer, sitting in front of a large, black, round microphone ball that's sitting on top of a mini tripod. And I have a cup of water sitting here next to me and some notes in front of me. And I probably should not be telling you this, but it's true. I'm wearing my Rocky Balboa t-shirt. And I feel humbled and honored and excited to be able to share with you this morning on this Good Friday. As we continue to shelter in place and pray for our medical doctors and nurses and staff and essential workers around the world. And for so many around our world, grieving and sick and dying because of the coronavirus, I pray that we will continue to lean into the presence and love of God and continue to extend our hands and feet and arms of love to everyone we can. Good Friday. The night before the first Good Friday, on Thursday night, after the Upper Room Passover meal, Jesus and his disciples go to the Mount of Olives, and Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane where he prays. And I recommend you read his prayer later, because it's a remarkable prayer. But soon, Judas arrives with a crowd of men armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and scribes and elders. And Judas walks up to Jesus and identifies him with a kiss. And they arrest Jesus and take him to the high priest. And the biographer Mark, in chapter 14, tells us that the high priest and all the chief priests, elders, and teachers of the law came together. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any evidence. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then, some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this man-made temple in 3 days and will build another, not made by man.'" Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" Verse 61, but Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You've heard this blasphemy." They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophesy!" And then the guards took him and beat him. And then they hand him over to the Roman governor, Pilate, who will question Jesus, and then authorize another round of torture. And then they will crucify him, nailing him to a wooden cross. Crucifixion, of course, was a brutal and barbaric form of execution. The way crucifixions are detailed in the history books, it's pretty obvious that if you had ever seen a crucifixion, and they were common in places like Judea and Galilee, that the experience would have been terrifying and the scene something that you would never get out of your head. Naked, half-dead men dying a prolonged death for days on end, covered in blood and flies and their flesh gnawed at by rats, their legs ripped at by wild dogs, their faces pecked by crows, the victims mocked by bystanders, while family nearby weep uncontrollably, helpless to do anything for them. And, historically speaking, we can be totally certain that Jesus was crucified. Rome had won again. Another young leader had been efficiently and effectively eliminated. Another group of followers were scared and scattering. And of course, this was no surprise to Rome. This is what they did best, which is why on Friday evening, nobody was saying, as they laid his body in the tomb, that his death had been a valiant victory, a magnificent martyrdom, a heroic happenstance. Nobody said, hey, the cross would be a great church logo, and we should sell gold crosses as jewelry and build churches with crosses on the roof. In fact, the opposite happened. His movement was finished. On Friday evening, Caesar was on his throne, death had the last word, and nothing had changed. Crucifixion meant that the kingdom had not come. Not that it had. Crucifixion of a would-be Messiah, and this wasn't the first, historically, meant that Jesus was not the Messiah, not that he was. When Jesus was crucified, every single disciple knew what it meant. Game over, pack your bags, quickly, because we'll be lucky to escape with our own lives. I'm saying, friends, read the Gospels. At no point do we even get a hint of anyone saying, oh, that's all right, he'll be back again in a few days. Nor did anyone say, well, at least he's in a better place now. No, what they said was, Luke 24 records this, for example, quote, we had hoped that he was the one who would redeem Israel. With the suggestion, of course, but they crucified him, so he can't have been. However, within days and then in the ensuing weeks, months, and years, in retrospect, upon review, and believe me, the New Testament writers reviewed and wrestled with this. They thought and talked and debated and studied. John 20, Luke 24, Acts 8, Paul's letter to the Romans, the early church writers, they're all wrestling with this crucifixion. And they come to the conclusion that what happened on Friday was, in retrospect, something good. That's right. I'm saying, despite all we know about crucifixion, Jesus' earliest biographers and followers start to call Friday good. They describe it as part of his vocation, the day that launched a new era in human history. And this is unprecedented. I mean, nobody, even in retrospect, has ever said something like, well, they crucified Uncle Joe, but it was a good thing after all. There was nothing good about crucifixion ever. And yet, Jesus' earliest followers come to see it as good. Good Friday. And I just think it ought to make us ask why. What was so good about Friday? And so today, on this Good Friday, I want to reconsider with you three things that, in retrospect, I think we too can agree are good about Good Friday. And first, Friday was good because on Friday, Jesus represented me in a cosmic battle. Friday was good because Jesus was my representative and your representative. Not, by the way, my substitute. And listen now, because there's a big difference between Jesus being our representative and Jesus being our substitute. Let me start with substitute. See, for many of us, we've grown up thinking that Jesus was our substitute. That God says, all have sinned, and the wages of sin is death. And so, I'm sorry, but I've got to punish you. Oh, wait. I'll go ahead and punish my son instead. He'll be your substitute. Pay the price I was going to mete out on you. And it's this image of a God who demands blood and who at the end of the day doesn't care a ton whose blood it is. And so God sends Jesus to a cross to take your place as your substitute. And while he's doing it, says, and oh, by the way, I'm doing it because I love you. But friends, that idea, the idea that you sinned and God hates sin and so he must destroy you, but wait, he killed his son instead, so now you get eternal life. This idea is actually not easily found in the Bible, but rather is very visible in ancient pagan literature. For example, six of Euripides' plays have substitution as a major theme. And there's an abundance of ancient legends in which people sacrificed either themselves or a favorite daughter or a special animal in order to gain divine favor or to ward off divine vengeance. Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, many others speak of dying for the law, for one's country, for one's friends, one's family, or even for the emperor. Horace, who lived in the years just before Jesus, asks in one of his odes, quote, to whom shall Jupiter assign the task of atoning for our guilt? Answer, to Augustus, who has assumed on earth the guise of man. I'm just saying that when we say that God says, I must punish those who sin, I must kill you, but wait, I'll kill my son instead. He'll be your substitute. That's a picture of a pagan God. And it's actually not the story of God that the Bible itself tells. Richard Rohr, the author and Franciscan priest, writes really, really powerfully about this in his book, The Universal Christ. Writing at one point, quote, it is not God who is violent. We are. It is not that God demands suffering of humans. We do. God does not need or want suffering, neither in Jesus nor in us. And this is why the writer of the book of Hebrews keeps talking about how God doesn't need the blood of animals. This is why Jesus himself, Matthew chapter 9 and chapter 12, says, "Go, learn the meaning of the words. What I want is mercy, not sacrifice." And he's quoting the prophet Hosea there, who further adds, "I want knowledge of God, not burnt offerings." Which is why, actually, new community, a better way to think about the cross is not that Jesus is my substitute, but rather that he is my representative. That Jesus fought a fight for me so I didn't have to fight. I remember in elementary school, 1980s, what was it called? Not fake wrestling, which is what I would call it, but worldwide wrestling. WWE, WWF, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Randy Savage. It's the genre where Dwayne The Rock Johnson began his road to fame. And back in the 1980s, they had something called tag team wrestling. 2-on-2, but only one fighter per team in the ring at a time. And the way it worked was, if you were the one in the fight, in the ring, and you got in trouble, you could tag someone who would jump in the ring for you. And he'd fight for the team and represent your team. And if he won the fight, then you would be the co-winner. One of my friends, I remember, loved the tag team duo, the Rock and Roll Express. Robert Gibson and Ricky Morton. Now, I admit that's a very crude theological example, but I do think it helps us see what the writers of Scripture always understood about the Messiah who would come, which is the Messiah would represent his people in the battle. He would fight the cosmic battle so we would not have to. And so, like David taking on Goliath on behalf of Israel as a whole, Jesus says that he can go by himself to do battle with the ultimate enemy. Jesus went into battle against evil, representing us, fighting for us. What's good about Good Friday? That Jesus went to battle for us. That Jesus is our representative against evil. And this is directly linked and leads to the second reason that Friday was Good Friday. Number two, not only did Jesus represent us, but he won. He won the victory. Not only did he fight for us, but he won for us. Paul says in Colossians chapter 2, quote, "Having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross." Paul says, on the cross, God has overcome evil. And all four gospel writers see the same thing. The cross is the moment when and the means by which the Creator God wins the victory over the forces of evil by the power of his love. "This is your hour and the power of darkness," Jesus says the night before his crucifixion, Luke chapter 22. Jesus says, "Evil, this is your chance to do your worst." And violence does do its worst against God. God does come to the very center of human horror. And God does take the worst that the world can do onto himself. And he exhausts it. And he triumphs over it. And if my friend Tyler is listening now, it's why I like Rocky IV the best. When Rocky Balboa goes into enemy territory and goes into the ring and faces the personification of evil, Ivan Drago. And Rocky allows Drago to do his worst. And he exhausts evil. And 12 rounds later, Rocky emerges victorious. And what the early biographers and followers of Jesus come to know is that with the resurrection, somehow, the powers of death were allowed to do their worst and then were defeated. This is why Paul later writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that the message of the cross is the very power of God. Verse 24, it is the unveiling of God's power and wisdom. This is why in John chapter 19, Jesus himself is quoted as saying on the cross, "It is finished. The work is complete." On Friday, Jesus wins the victory. And so death and the powers no longer have the same power. And as Jesus's followers look back on that Friday in the light of the resurrection, they came to the conclusion, well reasoned, that his death had launched a new era in human history. And so Friday was Victory Friday. And that's why it was Good Friday. And number three, the third reason that I think we can call Friday good is because it inspires us and calls us to be patient in our own trials. Because later, Jesus's followers will remember the suffering of Jesus as a source of hope in their own suffering. Later, they come to see that Jesus's Good Friday experience can give them patience for their Good Fridays and bad Mondays and painful eras. I'm saying the New Testament writers over and over and over tell how the early church takes comfort and hope in the middle of their trials because Jesus endured the cross and then triumphed over it. And while the resurrection of Jesus, I know, does not magically erase our tragedy or make our sufferings less significant, it does tell us something very important, which is that not even tragedy or death can separate us from the love of God. And I find this particularly meaningful in this coronavirus era when so many people are sick and dying, and so many still yet to die. And people's lives and employment and social worlds are in upheaval. And for many people, this raises all kinds of questions, including, where is God in this? And there's no simple answer to this question. But I do believe that every year, Good Friday speaks into that question. Not because it answers the question, but because it tells of a Jesus who suffered too, and who is patient unto death. and who suffered in hope and in trust and in confidence that a really good God would make things right again. Bear Grylls, can I quote him again? Bear Grylls writes in his book, I'm reading now, quote, I remember in the North African desert once when we were training with the French Foreign Legionnaires that we had a particularly unpleasant night. The corporals took shifts to ensure that we were woken up every 15 minutes all night until dawn. They would burst in and throw our kits all around and out the windows, turn the beds upside down, empty the lockers into the desert sand, only to do it over and over and over again the second we had tidied up. Grylls writes, but I will never forget one of the recruits, Bobby, at 4:30 a.m., during our darkest, most exhausting hour, when the corporals were in full swing, and we had been up all night in the face of this mindless, sleep-defying beating, Bobby looked at us, smiled, and said, breakfast is coming. Breakfast is coming. And for the rest of the darkness, we held on to that hope. Breakfast is coming. Grylls writes, and from that day on, whenever something has got really tough in my life, I say to myself, don't worry, breakfast is coming. And so, on this Friday, we can call it good because Jesus is our representative in the most important battle. And Jesus won the battle. And breakfast is coming.